This is Books for Breakfast, a podcast where we talk about books and writing. I'm Enda Wiley.
And I'm Peter Sir.
And you're all very welcome to this morning's show.
Today we'll be considering two books about looking and seeing and the relationship that we have with the environment around us.
And our guest will be poet and short story writer John O'Donnell. His new and debut collection of stories, Almost the Same Blue, published by Thera Press, has come out to great acclaim, and I'm really looking forward to hearing John rise to the toaster challenge and tell us all about his favourite book.
And we'll have a couple of poems for you at the end.
So, the coffee's made.
The toast is on.
And the books are on the table. So, Peter, I see on our breakfast table today, you've got not one but two books, and I'm looking forward to hearing you tell us a bit about them.
Yeah, well, I've been reading two books which, as it turns out, are kind of accidentally related in that they're both concerned with different kinds of looking and seeing, you know, how we perceive and relate to our environment, whether we're in a busy city or, in the case of the second book, The Wiltshire English Countryside. But the first book came out a few years ago, and it's called On Looking, A Walker's Guide to the Art of Observation, and it's by Alexandra Horowitz.
Yeah, I remember her books. Didn't she write one called Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell and Know? And she also wrote another book called Being a Dog. I think it was on the list for, you know, bestseller list on for the New York Times. I think Oprah championed these books. Yeah, really interesting.
That's right, yeah. And the walking comes into it, and indeed the dog comes into it as well. But it starts off, I mean, what I like about it, I mean, it's walking around the city. I mean, she begins with walking around her immediate New York neighborhood with her young son. And she talks about his neophilia, you know, his love of the new. In childhood, all is new, whereas I suppose we have seen it all before. We're a bit jaded. But when a child goes out, he or she sees a truck, tree guards, mushroom-hatted fire hydrants, a standpipe, and, you know, things we see every day but hardly look at. And that's, I suppose, the key to the book, is the difference between seeing and looking.
So the kind of imagination of the child seeing things in a new, interesting way. We're also jaded, aren't we, Peter?
Yeah, well, there's one, I mean, she says, I mean, about a child, that children have animistic imagination or perception. Like, to him, she says, the standpipe was as much a fellow creature as the bipedal primates looking down at him.
Yes, a very imaginative way of seeing the world. So what else does she tell us, Peter, about looking and seeing? There's a difference between the two, isn't there, in her view?
She has all these really interesting epigraphs to every chapter. One I liked a lot was, to find new things, take the path you took yesterday. And that was from the American naturalist John Burroughs. And it's an idea that appeals very much, because it's the central preoccupation of the book, if you like, that you need to look and then look again. And it's not, you know, how much you see or a great an area you see, but how intensely you observe what's around you.
Yeah, and also I was flicking through it because it's been hanging around our house, that book, for a while, and I saw a quote from Thoreau in it as well, and he said, it doesn't matter how far you travel, but how alive you are. I think that's a great quote too, isn't it? But listen, she takes walks. She doesn't do the walks on her own. She takes 11 walks with experts. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's to me one of the attractive elements of the book, because she takes her walks with experts in every kind of imaginable field. So she starts off walking with a geologist, and we get to know about the stones of the buildings in New York, you know, going back millions of years, to, you know, Vermont bluestone or schist. She goes around with an illustrator at one point, and, mm-hmm. you know, the illustrator says to her at one point, if you're ever bored or blue, stand on a street corner for half an hour and just look, you know. Or they wander around talking to people, speaking to people, interacting with people. But yeah, some of the experts are, you know, she has a man who's a doctor who she goes to Philadelphia, mm-hmm. and she walks around the city with him, and he can tell by just looking at people what kind of is wrong with them.
Oh, I think I'd be afraid to be looked at by that doctor. But anyway, that's a very interesting way of seeing the city. And the other thing is rats. Rats come up. Now, in another podcast, we featured a poem about rats by the Irish poet John Kelly. But in her book, rats feature as well, don't they? So will you tell us a bit about that?
Well, rats are all kinds of animals, actually, because there's a chapter on insects. You know, she goes around looking, examining insects with one expert. But yes, the rats, she says, some rats can distinguish between different languages, which is a very kind of new idea to me. But she says that the resident rats, for instance, in the basement of an apartment building with a building staff speaking a different language than the residents, can tell from their speech which group is possibly threatening their den and which will ignore them. I'd love to know how they found out that.
Wow, that is quite amazing. The other thing I was wondering is, when you were reading this book, was there any part of it where you felt extremely emotionally engaged? Was there any part where you were quite moved or touched by what she was describing?
I suppose I liked it all, but one of the most moving and interesting chapters for me is the one called Seeing, Not Seeing, where Horovitz navigates the streets in the company of Arlene Gordon, who's a woman who went blind in her 40s, but despite her blindness, has travelled widely and brought back mementos from everywhere, which she calls her pictures. And so the two of them journey through the city, and it's an instruction in another kind of seeing, you know, like a state of hyper-listening with all the senses engaged. And we learn about the art of stick work, for instance, knowing whether she can tell in New York if she's under an awning just from the different sound that the stick makes or the feel of the wind at intersections, you know.
It's quite poetic nearly, isn't it?
Well, I love, because she talks about this urban windscape. It's, to me, it's kind of a really interesting idea. And at the end of her walk with Horovitz, she kind of turns to her and says, you know, it was nice to see you. And, you know, you realise that sea has many definitions.
Yeah, it certainly does. Not the least of all the reasons, I think. I mean, you have been talking to me before about this book before we came onto the podcast. But, you know, the whole project of her book started with a walk with her dog, Finnegan. Isn't that right? And the last chapter is called A Dog's Nose View. I really love that name. So will you just explain a little bit about why did she name the chapter that?
Well, yeah, I suppose, I mean, because this is what she does. It's one of the things she does. She's an animal kind of behaviorist. And she has written, as you said, that book about dogs. But and so this whole project started with a walk with a dog. And the thing about dogs, I mean, a dog smells its way through the city. I mean, it pees to communicate with other dogs. It smells the pee notes from other dogs. I mean, we can't begin to imagine the odor-rich world we inhabit. I mean, it's a dimension that we don't really have access to, even if the word smell is kind of pitifully inadequate. I mean, I don't think a dog would be too impressed with it. I mean, all that, just one word. But, you know, something I learned, dogs are macrosomatic. We are microsomatic. In other words, big smellers versus feeble smellers. We are kind of smellily impoverished.
Oh, we're smelly. I love that. So in a way, the neighbourhood she walked around with her dog, Finnegan, was, I think she said, it was nearly like a patchwork of smells, and the dog was piecing it all together. Is that what she was talking about?
It's just, yeah, because we see it ourselves. I mean, as we walk around the streets with our own kind of with our own mutt, and you know, you'd have to know what goes on in a dog's head, and the sheer avidity with which a dog encounters and explores the world.
I know. Well, listen, Peter, thank you so much for talking to us today about Alexandra Horovitz's book, On Looking, A Walker's Guide to the Art of Observation. I don't think I'll ever go walking my neighbourhood with my dog again without thinking of this book. And every time he pees or sniffs at something, I'll be thinking of Alexandra Horovitz. So let's move on. And you've a second book there as well, which looks very interesting. And can you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, and it just happened that I've been reading this at the same time, you know, as Alexandra Horovitz's book. And it's a book of essays by the English poet Jeremy Hooker. And I kind of came to the poetry first and I liked it. And then I sent away for the essays. And they're very much related. I mean, because they all have to do with place in some shape or form. Place is very important to his work, not just the physical manifestation of nature, but the people who live in it or the work that was carried on in it over the centuries, you know, forgotten agricultural labourers and so on. And of course, as he reminds us, nature is a huge part of the fictional and poetic legacies of literature.
He was very influenced by people like Thomas Hardy, Edward Thomas, Robert Frost, poets who place huge emphasis on place and nature. So what has he got to say about those poets?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, he was hugely influenced by Hardy. And let's not forget as well, it was Hardy who said, one of the famous things he said was that the greatest things a human soul ever does is to see something. And, you know, that's like what we were talking about in the earlier book. It's the same thing, actually really kind of observing and seeing. And of course, he's very interested in people like Edward Thomas as well, and you know, because they have a very strong kind of relationship with place and Frost, or the journals of Dorothy Wordsworth, or people like Ruskin, or the 19th century nature writer Richard Jefferies, or Gerard Manley Hopkins, or but also Thoreau and William Carlos Williams in the States, you know?
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's kind of a vast, vast influences there. Also, the title of the book, Ditch Vision. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Ditch Vision, I mean, it's almost like he makes a distinction between, how Americans perceive nature and how writers in Britain, I suppose, maybe Ireland would come into that as well, perceive it. And he says, in America, it's all about kind of vast, unforgiving nature and would maybe shot through with guilt about the persecution of the indigenous kind of civilizations that were there. Whereas in England, what he's identifying is a kind of looking at things very closely, a kind of microscopic observation, the minutely particular description of rushes. This writer, Richard Jefferies, and that's where he gets this idea. Jefferies is just looking at it. He's describing a ditch and he's describing the scent of different grasses and ferns and rushes. And so that's his idea, like focusing on this one ditch.
Yeah, which is a really wonderful idea. And he also talks about the lucky poet. So what makes a poet lucky in his mind, in Jeremy Hooker's mind?
Yeah, well, he was quoting an English poet, Geoffrey Grigson, and who said that, in his view, a lucky poet was one that retained some kind of consciousness of his first territory. And you can think, John Clare, or you can think Auden, or Heaney, or Patrick Kavanagh, or many others, to whom place was important. And it doesn't just mean, though, that, a kind of sentimental love or of place or remembering place in tranquility, because it can be a troubled relationship as well. Like Edward Thomas wasn't ever particularly comfortable, and in the end he kind of laid down his life for a vision of England. He felt he had to die for it, or he felt he had to at least sign up as a soldier and go and fight for it,
Mm-hmm. So there can be discomfort as well in his vision of nature.
I think so. And I think that's important. And I think it's probably true of Jeremy Hooker in lots of places as well. And even Heaney, and if you think of Kavanagh, but if you think of, many poets for whom place is important, it's often a conflicted kind of relationship.
I mean, I was thinking about Heaney when he said, I think there are two ways in which place is known and cherished. One is lived, illiterate and unconscious. The other, learned, literate and conscious. So there's kind of two things going on, which can be interesting in how poets approach place. So, I mean, it's very interesting, these two books. They're all about ways of seeing, really, isn't it, Peter? Seeing the world. I think, in a way, we need to turn off our phones and all other electronic devices and be in the real world. In both books, they're quite fascinating about that we need to stop and look and observe and maybe go back again and again to look at these things. And not necessarily for comfort, as you said. It can be sometimes for discomfort as well.
To leave the final word with Jeremy Hooker himself, he says, I think of poetry as an art of seeing, an art by which, in my blindness, I learn to see. And I love that idea of learning to see in his blindness. The other thing I should say is that for anyone interested is that the book is also really useful for essays about people I didn't know about and found to be very interesting as well. Poets I wasn't familiar with, like Les Arnold or Francis Bellerby and others. So it's kind of a very educational book in that sense.
Yeah, that sounds like it was a brilliant book to find, Peter. Can you repeat the title again for our listeners? I'm sure they'd love to read these essays.
So that book is Ditch Vision, Essays on Poetry, Nature and Place by Jeremy Hooker.
That sounds brilliant. Well, listen, Peter, thank you so much for bringing in to Books for Breakfast two really interesting books about places and cities and ways of seeing and observing. And all details of those books will be available, as usual, on our website, www.booksforbreakfast.buzzsprout.com. I think I need an award for saying that, Peter. Anyway, we will move on. And now it's time for today's Toaster Challenge, where we have a guest and he's going to tell us about his favourite book. And that'll be in a few minutes. But first of all, I'd like to welcome John O'Donnell to Books for Breakfast. You're very welcome, John.
Nice to be here, Enda. Nice to see you, Peter.
Very nice to have you here. Well, first, I'll tell our listeners a little bit about John O'Donnell. His work has been published and broadcast widely in Ireland and abroad. Awards include the Hennessy Award for Emerging Fiction and the Courage Festival of Literature New Writing Prize for Fiction. But John is also a poet, and he's published four poetry collections, the latest of which is Sunlight, his new and selected poems published by Daedalus Press in, I think it was 2018, wasn't it, John?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And John is sitting there very modestly, but he's also won prizes for poetry, including the Irish National Poetry Prize, the Ireland Funds Prize, and the Hennessy Award for Poetry. He lives and works in Dublin with his children and his wife, Micheline, and he's just published his debut collection of stories, Almost the Same Blue, which has been so positively reviewed. And that's really great news, John. I'm sure you're thrilled to have received all those wonderful reviews. We will be having other writers in, Marianne Lee, whose new book, A Quiet Tide, has just come out, and Alice Lyon's new novel, Una, both debut collections. They were launched also in lockdown, as was your book. But it's great to get positive feedback. I'll just quote some of the wonderful reviews you got. The Irish Times said that Almost the Same Blue is captivating. It's a high-octane debut collection. The Independent said it's a versatile debut collection. It shows many sides to the short story. And then the Business Post said sharply observed short stories that catch the complexity of life. So congratulations, John. You are really, really welcome here today. I'd like to start by asking you about your day job. You're a senior counsel in Dublin, and Peter and I were wondering, does your day job help with ideas for writing stories? I'm thinking particularly of a story like Shelley, which deals with assault.
Yeah, there are. I mean, there are obviously areas where there is a crossover. I mean, I suppose at a fundamental level, a lawyer like a writer is looking for the absolutely precisely correct word. And that's part of what you do when you're writing. You're looking for the exact words. That's one idea. Another idea, I suppose, is the idea that as an advocate, you, as a lawyer presenting cases in court, you're telling your client's story. And that's a kind of a very important part of being an advocate. But it's also an important part of being a writer, that you're presenting a story. You're trying to engage with your audience or your readers. And you have to get them in. You have to make them listen if they can, because if they don't want to listen, your client's chances of success are reduced. So there's that. That's part of it as well. And then, yes, of course, there's I suppose as a primary source of inspiration, I'm at the bar for 36 years now. So you meet so many people, you hear so many different stories, both from clients and from colleagues, and you see so much of what life is about. That inevitably there is going to be inspiration, not necessarily direct, but some indirect inspiration. And one of the stories that you mentioned, Shelley, is inspired by a story that a colleague told me about a young boy who indecently assaulted a young girl.
Yeah, so I think what you said there as well, you're a poet as well, and there's an impressive amount of details in your stories. Poets, like I suppose, like senior counsels, they really thrive on the details. So does being a poet, you were a poet first and foremost, did that help with the writing of the stories and the details that you put into them?
Well, I think the more convincing detail you have, the more true the story will read. And so you need, I remember Paul Muldoon telling us in a workshop years ago that making a poem should be like making a little film. And so I think of that also when I'm writing a story, that you go in really close up with the camera to see exactly what is happening, and to try and describe exactly the texture of somebody's skin or the sound of their voice or whatever it is you're describing, but that you really do have that intensity of focus. And that is, as you say, something that comes from poetry as well, or my poetry anyway.
Yeah, and that thing about texture, I love that word texture, because it made me immediately think of the story Young Woman with Unicorn, which is set in 16th century Rome in your collection. It's one of my favourite stories, actually, John. I love the details and the texture of the specific life of that young woman. Without giving away too much, she's in Rome, she's in a palace in the Vatican, and she's modelling for the painter Raphael, isn't that correct?
That's right, yeah.
What a great story. Amazing detail. I really felt like I was there in the place. So I remember also the short story writer Mary Costello, she's also a fine novelist, also
wonderful
saying
story
that,
writer, yeah,
really good writer, saying that a short story works best if a reader feels like they're stepping right in to a person's life from the very beginning, and then when they leave the story, they feel as if they want to hear more and what's going to happen to the journey of that person. Is this something that you would agree with? Is this something you tried to do, to leave a kind of significant space for the reader when you were writing your stories?
I suppose I know that I'm not going to be able to tell the entire life story of the person who, or people who feature in the stories. So I suppose, like in any short story, you're trying to suggest what might happen in the future and what might have happened in the past. And there's an element of that. I'm not conscious of leaving a gap, but I suppose inevitably when the short story focuses on an incident or a series of incidents, you inevitably don't try to describe from birth to death the life of the characters, whereas obviously in a novel that you have that option.
You'd be doing that. And I suppose I'm thinking of that story, the wonderful story Partners, where I was really left wondering at the end about poor old Roland with his shoes and what was going to happen next. So I would urge everyone to read this collection because they're all so different and varied. Well done, John. I just entered each story not knowing where I was going to go. I suppose, as the poet Elizabeth Jennings said about poetry, it's a journey and you're not quite sure where you're going to go. I felt that with your stories and I love the surprise of them. But I was wondering as well, I'm sure there are people out there listening, wondering, who like to write and are wondering, well, how do you start? And your first short story, which is in the collection, The Promise, that first appeared in the Hennessy New Irish Writing Page. I think Kieran Carty chose to publish it. Is that right,
yeah,
John?
Yeah, but there's again, like as you point out, I've been writing poems and I've had a number of collections of poetry published, but I hadn't written a story since I was at school, which is a very long time ago.
And it was so old, John.
Well, I'm not. I'm obviously a lot older than you guys. But it was only when somebody came up to me at the law library at my desk and said, "We're putting together an anthology. We want you to put in a short story. And by the way, in case you're thinking of trying to wriggle out of it, it's for charity." So I kind of said, and that was in 2008, and I had never written a story, as I say, since I'd been at school, which was kind of a very long time ago. Even then. And so I kind of read and found something in the newspaper. Beryl Bainbridge said you could write a book just by reading the newspaper. You could write stories by reading the newspaper. And I found a story in a newspaper about a fundraising event for a rugby player who had been paralysed in an accident during a match and confined to a wheelchair. And I began to think, because I'd played myself, I began to think, what would that be like? What would you do? How would you feel about the rest of your life and so on? And I started to write that. And as I say, the anthology never happened, but Kieran Carty in the New Irish Writing Page took it and published it. And
I know, and it was a really great platform for emerging writers.
Yeah.
I remember even David Marcus from way back was the initiator of it and brilliant as well.
That's nice.
Then I'm thinking of people like The Stinging Fly and Sean O'Reilly. He's a really great teacher and writer himself of writing. And the Texan writer, Greg Baxter, he ran writing classes as well. Were they all helped you along the way, didn't they, John? In the craft of writing?
Yeah, I mean, there's somebody, I remember somebody saying once that, workshops can't make you into a writer, but I think they can make you into a better writer. You need a basic level of skill, and I think I was certainly recommended. I met somebody at the Hennessy Awards, which I didn't win, but somebody at the Hennessy Awards said, why don't you go to Greg Baxter? I'd never heard of him. And he was very, very tough. He really was. And you know, there would be tears in some of the sessions that he said. But he said, if you're going to write, you're going to have to explore the parts of yourself that you mightn't like, the parts that you might be afraid of. And obviously that's, part of what makes the stories, I hope, what makes stories interesting.
Then
The Stinging Fly, likewise, the Sean O'Reilly, he's a fantastic writer himself, but he also has a steely northern intolerance for slackness or for bad writing, and he kept telling us, tighten it up, justify what you're saying. Is there evidence for what you're saying? And of course, that's all very helpful in kind of helping us to structure and write a story.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of the poet Michael Hartnett, who said that the poet has to be the poem's first critic. So you were basically learning to be the critic of your own work. And that steeliness, I agree, it is definitely needed if you're going to write. A bit of courage as well, John, is needed, isn't it? To take that leap.
Yeah,
definitely.
People can do it, a lot of it. I mean, as Stephen King said, all writing is rewriting. So an awful lot of it is just applying yourself to it rather than just going with the first draft, but certainly the work, those classes definitely helped me, and I wouldn't be, I don't want to call myself the writer, but I wouldn't be where I am. I wouldn't have published that book without the help of those classes and those writers.
Yeah, well, that's a fantastic tribute to them. I mean, it is a journey, isn't it? And you're well on it, John. It's a fantastic collection. I really, really enjoy
it. You're very kind. I'm glad you liked it.
So you're getting a big head now, John, aren't you, today? So, I'm just wondering as well, if looking back on your debut collection now and all those stories, each story hard-earned, hard got there, you worked hard, but hopefully fun along the way as well. But if you were to choose a story of your own that's special to you in this collection, which would you choose?
Well, that's a really difficult question because, you know, you're not often asked to choose one of your children and say which one you prefer.
I'm a bit mean, John. Sorry about that.
I suppose the one that I have that I suppose reflects in some way my experience as a lawyer is a story called Ichthyanthrope, which is the last story. When we come on to the toaster challenge, you'll see why it's of significance to me. But it's an exchange between a lawyer and his client and her client, and there's a bit of everything in it. But it's also, I suppose, an insight into the mind of a client who has done or may have done something absolutely terrible.
Okay, and that exactly fits in. I'm not going to give anything away to the listeners to your toaster challenge. So I think, John, actually, thanks so much for all that. It was great to chat to you and congratulations again on the book. We'll move on now, will we, to the toaster challenge. And thanks very much for coming in to agree to do this. So I think Peter is getting the toast ready there. He's going to pop it into the toaster. Lovely sourdough bread today, John. It smells lovely.
I like my toast well done, so I may be a little bit longer than 2 minutes.
Oh, good. Now, we have our timer at the side. Peter, sir, is going to keep an eye out. So, but if you go a little over, that's okay, John. So I'm going to count you down. 1, 2, 3. And you're going to talk about your favourite book. Off you go.
Okay, the book I've chosen is The Book of Evidence by John Banville. And it's a book that was written almost 40 years ago. But just over 30 years ago. But it is a marvellous book. It's based on a series of murders that took place in Ireland in 1982. In the summer of 1982, a nurse was beaten to death in the Phoenix Park in Dublin. 2 days later, a man called Donal Dunn, a farmer, was shot by his own shotgun. And the man who was eventually arrested and charged with these offences was a man called Malcolm MacArthur. Now, he was an eccentric. He cultivated this idea of himself as being a very cultured, eccentric academic, although he was, in fact, nothing of the sort. But shockingly, when the police were chasing him, he was eventually found in the apartment by the sea of the then Attorney General, the Irish government's legal advisor, the late Patrick Connolly. And obviously that added enormously to the controversy because the idea that a murderer would be found in the Attorney General's apartment was unthinkable. And he eventually pleaded guilty in 1983 and he was sentenced to life imprisonment, which was the mandatory murder sentence. And he's in fact was released in September of 2012, so he served almost 30 years in prison. But the book, which was written in published in 1989, The Book of Evidence, is clearly based on the life on MacArthur and on what he did. There's this character called Freddie Montgomery, and the book takes place in Freddie Montgomery's cell while he's awaiting trial, and you learn fairly early on that there's no question but that he did it. He's guilty, and he's going to plead guilty. But it's his story to his lawyer or to anyone who's listening, and some people might think it's to himself, about what he did and the circumstance in which he came to do it. And it's fascinating on a number of bases. One of the things I suppose we look for as readers in a book is the unreliable narrator. And while Banville somewhat archly says, oh, well, I've never thought of this as being based on fact. I have no sense of responsibility to the truth. But in one of the interviews, when the police say to Montgomery / MacArthur, why did you do it? Or, you know, how much of what you're telling us is true? He says, all of it. And then he says, none of it. So you don't know what to make of him. So that's a fascinating. And he says, well, what else of it is true? He says, only the shame is true. And that's a great line. And then there are the actual title of the book is also amazing. The Book of Evidence is the collection of documents and evidence that the prosecution normally present in any charge against an accused. But it wouldn't necessarily include a statement from the accused if the accused didn't want to make one. So this is, I suppose, an inversion of that. One of the other great things about this book is that Banville is mocked widely for, you know, using big words that you need a dictionary to look up, or forgetting about the plot and falling in love with the writing. But he actually refers to this. Montgomery, on one occasion, says when he explains himself as using a word like balanic bliss, he says, yes, I have got hold of a dictionary. So he's laughing at himself. And he says at another stage where he, having given us a long passage of lyrical prose, he says, oh, by the way, the plot, it almost slipped my mind. So he's mocking and laughing at himself, which is not something that John Banville always does, or certainly wouldn't have a reputation for doing. And obviously, then I'm intrigued by the drama that he makes of real life events. That's marvelous, because I love those books. I love a book like Libra, which is Don DeLillo's book about the Kennedy assassination. That's a marvelous thing to do, and that's very clever. It's also very daring, because there was an awful lot of controversy about this book, not just about the events, but about this book. And then what I love about it as well is that it asks questions about the art of making art. And I think that's fascinating. Banville is constantly breaking what you might call the fourth wall and saying, well, you know, I want to talk to you about why I'm doing this. And in fact, Banville, with some pride, has recounted that his first wife said to him when he was coming back from a day's writing, you look like a murderer who's just come back. You look like a murderer who's just come back from a particularly bloody killing. And I think that's a marvelous description by somebody who knew him pretty well.
That's great, John. I'm just coming in now with a slice of slightly charred
black
toast to say, because we could go on all. It's such an enthralling book, a great book in a marvelous and ongoing career. John Banville, he often says that he loathes his own books. And he's swift to move on to the next best thing. So I think that's maybe one of the things that makes him such an interesting writer. But John, thanks a million for that kind of, I know it's a terrible thing in a way, that kind of quick snapshot of a writer in 2 to 3 minutes in a toast time. But I think you got to the nub of that extraordinary book. So thanks very much for that.
I'm sorry if the toast was overdone.
John, thank you as well. It just makes me want to go back and read the Book of Evidence again. John Banville has always been one of my favourite writers. I remember first encountering him when I was in college and reading Kepler and the Newton Letter, all brilliant books. And I really just wanted to continue on. I read somewhere that somebody said of his writing, it possesses the kind of denseness and thickness that poetry has. So I can see why you as a writer, both as a poet and a short story writer, feel connected to him. And I'm thinking back to Charles Haughey as well. How can we ever forget him? When he said about that incident, it was a bizarre happening, an unprecedented situation, a grotesque situation, an almost unbelievable mischance, the famous Gubu.
That's right. Yes,
it really is. It is fiction, isn't it? And so I think Banville was right to net it. But yeah, definitely we'll all be reaching for Banville again in this house. John, thank you so much. Just to remind everyone again that John O'Donnell's new debut collection, Almost the Same Blue, published by Dira Press, is out. It is definitely available. And all details about John and his writing will be on our website, www.booksforbreakfast.buzzsprout.com. So we'll head onwards to coffee and toast. Thank you, John O'Donnell. Well, earlier on, we discussed the critical essays of English poet Jeremy Hooker, and we thought it would be nice to end today's Book for Breakfast podcast by reading two of his poems, two poems that we both very much admired. So, Peter, which poem of Jeremy Hooker's would you like to read?
Yeah, I'm going to read a poem called Nobbot Dick Jeffries, and it comes from a kind of dialect thing like, seed you out on the downs, Nobbot Dick Jeffries mooning about. And it's about this nature writer that I talked about, Richard Jeffries. And it's about that idea that, you know, mooning about in nature wasn't considered a very kind of manly thing to do. You weren't supposed to be looking at nature. You're supposed to be doing stuff in it. You're supposed to be working in it. So he had that sort of conflict between, you know, this is what he wanted and needed to do, to dream, if you like, and observe. You know, but there was a guilt associated with that as well. So that's where that comes from. So Nobbot Dick Jeffries. No one but him, mooning in a backwater of the 19th century. We've walked apart from the houses, and here on the edge of a common under pines, light in every facet dances round his words. Such tenderness is unbearable, the point of a grass blade on the eyeball, even from the flower head of a slender foxtail, a branch grows over the earth's side, and he is stopped where it bends, trying the body's weight against the bough's strength. The knowledge will not disclose itself, nor the world make something of him, though the extremity starts from its roots.
Oh, that was really beautiful, Peter. Thanks very much for reading that. And I'm going to conclude by reading a poem of his. It's a very well-known poem. It's called Landscape of the Daylight Moon. And I thought I'd read it because actually I saw a quote from Jeremy Hooker talking about his childhood. And he said, "From early on, from boyhood, I was haunted by chalk landscapes, which I first saw from the back of my parents' car. Many years later, I looked at paintings by Paul Nash, who is also obviously haunted by the same and similar chalk landscapes." And so I'm going to read his poem called Landscape of the Daylight Moon. "I first saw it inland. Suddenly, round white sides rose through the thin grass, and for an instant in the heat, it was dazzling. But afterwards, I thought mainly of darkness, imagining the relics of an original sea under the chalk, with fishes beneath the fields. Later, everywhere upon its surface, I saw the life of the dead, circle within circle of earthen shells, and in retraced curves, like finger marks in pale sand, the print of a primeval lover. Once climbing in a dusty track, I found a sun-shaped urchin with the sun's rays white with the dust of the moon. Fetish, flesh became stone. I keep it near me. It is a mouth on darkness, the one inexhaustible source of recreation."
And that was Enda reading Landscape of the Daylight Moon by Jeremy Hooker.
I think we've reached the end of our Books for Breakfast podcast this morning. I'm definitely rushing off to have more coffee. And I'm Enda Wiley, and I have Peter Sarah here with me. And Peter, would you like to tell everyone about the details of the podcast if they'd like to listen again?
Well, you can subscribe at all the usual sources, Google and Apple and so on. And if you want to check out the notes that go along with this podcast, you can go to booksforbreakfast.buzzsprout.com. And yeah, so
we'll be back again next Thursday morning. We'll have the toast on, we'll have the kettle boiling, we will have more books to discuss, and we're looking forward to having you here. So goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.